Welcome to the Right Turn Radio Podcast. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean.
And you're listening to New England's foremost addiction and mental health program. Abby, how are you?
Pretty good. I'm really excited about this show.
I'm very excited about this show.
It's very timely. We all have so much to learn, yes.
We have a lot to learn. We have some great guests. We're talking tonight about technology addictions and how they affect us. It's everywhere.
Well, it's really interesting. We talk a lot about our kids and our friends and us and how we, you know, what we're trying to do to keep our technology under control in our lives. And it's nice to start hearing some research about it.
It's good. There's different voices weighing in. You know, parents, myself included, get frustrated just seeing how intensely kids react to, you know, screens and to games and to social media. And
it's not just kids. You know, the average grown-up checks their cell phone 110 times a day.
That sounds about right. And there's dangers of texting and driving. Here's some stats. You are 23 times more likely to get into an auto accident while you're texting.
And it delays your reaction time. So in the time you have, like, you just look away for 3 to 5 seconds, you've crossed the equivalent of a football field.
And so, which kind of brings up one of our guests joining us on the phone from Northern California is Matt Richtel. Matt is a Pulitzer Prize-winning technology reporter for the New York Times. And he's the author of several books, including A Deadly Wandering, which we're going to talk a little about tonight, The Devil's Plaything, and he has a new novel called The Doomsday Equation that has hooked Abby Dean immediately in the first few pages. Matt, welcome to Right Turn Radio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And in the studio with us is Dr. Michael Rich, pediatrician in adolescent medicine at Children's Hospital Boston. He's the director of the Center on Media and Child Health and an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Welcome, Dr. Rich.
Thank you.
So I think the first thing we want to hear about is from you, Matt. We wanted to hear how you got into this research and that eventually led to the Pulitzer Prize.
First, let me just say hi to Michael. Hi, Dr. Rich.
I know.
Hi, Matt.
He's in your book.
I was so psyched that you were going to be on the show with me.
Ordinarily, there's not people listening over our shoulders when we talk.
So I guess we better behave ourselves then.
You're making me look good. You've paired me with such good company. But
you're welcome, Matt.
Your lead-in is perfect for how I got into this, because I didn't get into it about texting and driving, and I actually think that's really just a jumping off point, a canary in the coal mine. I got into this because here I was in Northern California writing about technology for the New York Times, and to be honest, there are a lot of technology reporters of different shades and stripes, and a lot of them, like, you know, really care about the new iPhone, whatever. I don't as much. I care about people's behavior, and I watched my own. And I could not believe, I literally could not believe the compelling lure of my device. Mm-hmm. And so I began to look at it, and I began to look at it first through the lens of texting and driving. And why? Because very simply, if you can be piloting a 2-ton missile down the road and still can't tear yourself away from the device, if you can't do that, then the collection of that behavior tells us an awful lot about just how compelling the device is. And so I began there, and I looked both at the behavior, the law, the characters, and finally, and with no small help from Dr. Rich and people like him, I looked at the neuroscience. And you're all leading in the right direction with your setup. There's a very profound question about whether this is merely habit-forming or actually addictive.
And the difference would be?
Well, the difference would be that there is I'll ultimately defer to Dr. Rich in this, but there are very, very concrete definitions for addiction that come in the DSM, and some of them revolve around what happens to changes in your brain, and there is even a discussion, a very, very well thought out discussion about whether behaviors can be addictive as opposed to substances. And in this case, the interaction with the device gets even more complicated because is it a behavior or a substance? Certainly, it appears that you are having a neurochemical experience when you interact with your phone. But I want to pause and say, I've talked about this a lot, and you'll have to take me at my word. We're moving too quickly in this conversation.
Yes.
I think it would help to back up and tell you a little bit about what's happening inside the brain when you interact with your device and why the debate is happening.
Is this by design, or is this just kind of a natural byproduct of the interaction with technology?
You know, my own guess would be that it begins as happenstance, that there are a million bazillion products created, and some resonate more than others. And this goes all the way back to the TV, when that was adopted about as quickly as any consumer technology. There is a very, very clear connection between the television and this screen, but this is the television on steroids. And once it began to resonate, businesses then became more deliberate around tweaking it to make it that much more addictive. And I use the word addictive there as opposed to saying it is addictive. But let me say why really quickly. And again, we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, but just let's be really clear about one thing. Let me ask you a trick question. Is Yahoo, Mail, Gmail, Google, Twitter, is it free? Is Facebook free?
No.
What do you pay with?
Your attention.
You pay with your attention, full stop. That is the currency. The more you are on, the more of your attention they have, the more of your information they have, the more they can target ads against it. You've heard the term eyeballs. Are they keeping your eyeballs? This stuff may not, they might not sit down and say, let's make this more addictive, but they sit down and say, how do we keep people on this more? Well, so in that respect, it is very deliberate.
So I'm interested in hearing from Dr. Rich, what is this mechanism, the neural mechanism what neurons are firing when I'm seeing people like my picture on Facebook or when I'm playing Xbox or any of that stuff?
It's the same neurons that fire when you eat something good or someone looks at you in a way that says, I love you, or when you score a touchdown. It is a squirt of dopamine that says, success, I've succeeded. I would go even further, perhaps, than Matt has and say that I think that while the initial discovery was happenstance, I think very early on in the television era and certainly in the interactive screen era, that they have actively manipulated this dopamine squirt to get that satisfaction. And in fact, many psychologists spend a lot of time designing video games so that they are just hard enough to keep you at them and then give you the success, and then give you the next level to go to.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. My son said, are you going to talk about me? And I said, do you want me to? He said, no. So here I go. When he was playing Angry Birds, do you guys remember that?
Oh,
that was
like
seven game generations ago.
It was so 2013.
He lost it because he felt like the pigs were laughing at him. And it got too hard for him, so he had to take it away. And it was really, really interesting because I think he had missed that, like, when he was succeeding, they were supposed to be cheering him on, but he thought they were jeering him. So I was watching. I thought I was good, getting better at it, and then I realized that it was just like the seventh try or the random fifth try or whatever. It would just work and had nothing to do with skill. It was heartbreaking for him and me.
It's paranoia.
Oh, yeah. Poor thing.
So
yeah. Can I say,
Talk.
Can I throw in a little bit of brain science here, and then Dr. Rich can tell me where, again, I really say with all respect, he's the man. I'm in a way sort of a translator. I talk to a million of these. Well, they're not a million. There's several dozen at his caliber, and I listen to them and try to translate. But might I give you a little bit of a parallel that I've learned from these guys that
helps
me understand the lore? He's talked about dopamine. That is really one of about a handful of ways to think about just how seductive our devices are. And the one the scenario that I find really compelling to think about is to imagine that you are a cave person tending to a fire, and you get a tap on the shoulder. Now, would you be able to not turn around and see who's there?
No.
It sounds like a double negative. Of course you have to turn around.
You
don't know if it's opportunity or threat. Now, similarly, if you're in the car or anywhere and your phone rings, it's a proverbial tap on the shoulder from anywhere, anyone, anywhere in the world. And just to do a little bit of put a little reduction sauce on the neuroscience here, when you're tending to the fire, that's the front part of your brain. It's the prefrontal cortex. It's your executive control. It's the thing that makes us most human in the brain, probably without any argument, but Dr. Rich can, again, correct me if I'm wrong. But when, and that's focusing on the fire or driving or your homework or your spouse or your partner or your job or this conversation. But when the signal comes from the phone or the tap on the shoulder, it sends a kind of laser shot from the bottom of the brain, from the reptilian part. The survival mechanisms, they say reorient or maybe die. It's awfully hard to ignore that, and that is a balance that is constantly being struck between our top-down, that attention, the stuff in the front, the prefrontal cortex, the attention and focus, and the top-down and the bottom-up.
So before we go to the break, I just want to make clear that this is not a choice that we're having. This is affecting us at a level that's been evolutionized into us and
Good
makes
word.
Us react. I don't even know if that is a word. We're talking about technology addictions, and you're listening to Right Turn Radio. We'll be back right after the break. In the studio by Dr. Michael Rich, who is a pediatrician in adolescent medicine at Children's Hospital Boston. He's also director of the Center on Media and Child Health, and we're going to have him talk a little bit about that. On the phone from Northern California is Matt Richtel. Matt is a Pulitzer Prize-winning technology reporter for the New York Times. He's author of several books, and his latest novel is called The Doomsday Equation. And Matt, you hooked Abby in the first few pages, apparently.
More than the first.
And I've never seen her this excited about reading a book.
This actually turns out to be reading that book is a healthy addiction.
That's
other substance you're using, put it down. That's equation.
Quickly.
So I wanted to talk to Dr. Rich because he was talking about he was telling us amazing stories about during, and I'd love to hear some of them over the air but you first wanted to comment on what Matt had just talked about.
Well, Matt very cogently laid out the issue, which is that we have our prefrontal cortex where our executive functions lie, which is sort of our highest level of thinking, fighting with our reptilian survival brain, and it will always lose unless you use it in advance. If you think of our executive functions, our prefrontal cortex, essentially as the air traffic controller for our attention and our thoughts, that it is being interrupted by these pokes. But if you use it before you get in the car and you turn the phone off, you will not be poked. And so we can make that decision in advance. And let's face facts, folks. We are not carrying the nuclear launch codes. There's something ultimately narcissistic about feeling that we have to respond to every text that comes in.
Wait
a minute. What are you trying to say?
You will not lose your job. You will not lose the love of your life. You will get to your destination, and then you can check the text.
Well, and you were also talking about the reason for research is because, you know, we know it's affecting kids now, but we don't know what's going to do. You know, what's this mean for 20 years from now, 30 years? You know, what happened to their, you know, frontal cortex? Oh, well.
Well, that is the interesting question, which is that we do know that the brain develops in response to the environmental challenges and stimuli it gets. We learned a lot from finding the Romanian orphans that were essentially warehoused for years without stimulation. And we don't know how the human brain is going to develop in response to this constant activation, stimulation, distraction.
Those pings.
Now, tell us about the center on media and child health. Why did you guys start that?
Well, we started it about a dozen years ago now because there was around this issue of media and children in particular, but media and the way we were all using them, much more heat than there was light. Lots of people had strong opinions about kids shouldn't be exposed to commercials and kids shouldn't watch violence or kids shouldn't be couched at potatoes and get fat. But no one really had put together the data. And so we formed it to, so that we could create a center where we knew what the truth was, where we had a gold standard, so that just as we use nutrition science to understand what we feed our children's bodies, we will understand what we're feeding our children's minds and how that's likely to affect their physical, mental, and social health.
Now, you treat children at Children's Hospital for screen addictions, for technology addictions. Can you give us a couple case studies of things that you've seen or trends that you've seen or extreme kind of addictions when this thing takes over?
Well, to place this in context, this is not yet recognized as an actual disease or an actual problem by the medical community. They feel that it requires more study. However, I am seeing more and more kids who are really suffering and families who are disrupted by this. These are kids who are staying up all night, gaming, social media, sometimes porn, not getting out of bed and going to school in the morning. Sometimes, you know, when their parents cut them off, they will get on the smartphone. I have had parents who are sleeping with the family's router under their pillows, and the kids who are sneaking in at night and stealing it. These are serious, serious problems. I've had kids who've had to be transported from their homes to care facilities in order to basically break this addiction.
Wow.
Matt, is this the same as other process addictions? Is it? How does it fit into the category here?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'll say that Dr. Rich knows this so much better, but maybe a better parallel is gambling than it is to substances, because there's a big debate on whether gambling belongs in the DSM as an addiction, and it's a behavior as opposed to a substance. With a substance, you do actually see prolonged changes in the brain, and as Dr. Rich referred to, it's not clear yet what kind of changes we're going to see in the brain. And I'd also add this bit of caution to it. There's an interesting line to be walked here in the discussion. Have you ever noticed how you go on vacation, if you're still able to go on vacation, and you turn off your device and you start to become a little bit more deliberate, to be a little more intentional, to be able to make better
Everybody's
decisions?
Nodding. Yes.
Everybody's
yes.
Nodding.
Okay, sorry. Enough said. That says to me that there are reparable there are short-term repairs that can be done. I want to make a comment on something Dr. Rich said, which is so potent. So that's a big difference. What are the changes in the brain? That's the question as it fits into the spectrum. You know, and you look. I just lost a very dear colleague, David Carr.
Yep.
Who was an addict and wrote about it in a terrific book, The Night of the Gun.
Great writer.
Great writer, died far too young. I don't know this, so I hope I won't be, you know, I only mean this to say it would not be beyond expectation that he did real damage to his brain and body over the long run through all manner of substance, and I'm not sure that our device does that. But I do want to, may I make a comment on Dr. Rich's wonderfully astute remark about making a decision ahead of time?
Yes.
Yes.
There's a terrific, the reality is, if you don't make the decision ahead of time, it gets very hard to make the decision later, and not just for the reasons he and I have described. The dopamine squirt, the tap on the shoulder, the clash between top-down and bottom-up attention. It's because when you are confronted with a lot of information, your decision-making power, your willpower gets impinged. And I'll give you a quick study to support this. You may have heard it before, but These folks walk in a room and they're allowed to choose between chocolate cake and a fruit snack. And some of the people, the study subjects, have to remember a short string of numbers beforehand and during, and those people are much more likely to choose the cake. What does it tell us? It tells us, and this is true of a number of other studies, that the more you have to juggle inside your brain, the less able you are to have access to the best decision-making power. It's as if your willpower, the thing you call free will, is impinged by the amount of information.
Our choices taken away from us is part of the message here, and part of the fears of people. And you know, is technology bad for us, or is this just the modern era? Matt, you make a great point. When we come back, we're going to discuss more about this huge topic. You're listening to Right Turn Radio. We'll be back right after the break. Tonight we're talking about technology addictions and technology, the behaviors around technology, how it's changing our lives, how it might be changing our brains, how it's certainly impacted our entire culture in a way that is yet to be determined.
Yeah, it certainly has. And we have with us Matt Richtel, who I have a question for. Matt, you know, you've done all this research, and you talk about the relationship between people and their technology. What have you come to terms with? Because technology takes people for quite a ride. And I wanted to see where you think it's all going.
Well, where it's going or where we're going?
Where we're going with our technology.
Where we're going with our technology. I think we're going in a place where the parallel is to food. You know, when we had the industrialization of food, it was on the whole a really great thing. More calories to more people, even through processes that, you know, that we've questioned a bunch. But at the same time, we created junk food. Everything you ever could want on a primitive level at a vending machine, and it led to obesity and diabetes. And I think the parallel is that technology is a lifeblood in many great ways, just as the industrialization of food is great. And we have to determine what is junk food. And I draw personally from a quote Dr. Rich gave me a few years ago. Dr. Rich, I don't know if you'll remember this quote, but may I just say something that he said to me, and
sure,
Hopefully he'll elaborate. I try to live this in my own life, and boy, is it hard. He said, he was for a front page story in the Times, and I tell audiences this young and old all the time, and I cite his name. He said, bring back boredom. He said, quiet time, downtime is to the brain what sleep is to the body. And what he's saying is that our brain, to process information, to make good decisions, needs to wrestle with the quiet moments. And this is the last thing I'll say, and I'm really anxious to hear what he has to say, but I just reread William Cope Moyer's book, Broken. Are you familiar with it? About addiction?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he talks so much, and this is a place where I do see the parallel. It's a wonderful book if you haven't read it, about how hard he had to struggle to deal with the quiet moments in life.
Right.
They are existential moments. Who am I? What am I doing? In those come truth, beauty, self-actualization. if you are denying yourself those, whether through a phone or a substance, you'll never get there. Dr. Rich, did I get you accurate on that?
Absolutely. When I speak to audiences, I remind them that 100 years ago, actually this year, there was an extremely bored patent officer in Switzerland who used to walk to work beside the river looking at the eddies and flows of the water and stamping a bunch of meaningless papers all day. After doing that, he would go home, go upstairs, and write up a little thing called the theory of relativity.
That's right.
Late in his life, when he was asked, how did you come up with this incredibly complex theory that no one has yet disproven, he said, it's because I was bored.
But mom, I tell you one thing, when the kids are the quietest is when they have this, the screens in them. You know, they're holding onto the script. Yeah, exactly.
They would be quiet if they were full of heroin, too.
That's right. Wow. That's okay. And in fact, there have been. Very good point.
Anyway, you guys, this is why journalists call Dr. Rich.
Good sound bites.
We call these guys quote monkeys.
Yes.
Oh, I've never heard that before. Okay. Now I'm getting back to my evolutionary roots.
This is, are we being alarmists? Is this just technology? Have people been doing this, you know, sounding the alarm about each new piece of technology that comes out? Or is this really, are we on the head of the spear here, and are we in trouble?
I don't think we should be alarmists about this, because what happens with alarmists is everybody springs to their previously held positions and fights back. This is not about alarm. This is about awareness. This is about saying, let's take a step back and stop saying should and shouldn't, right and wrong, and say, how are we changed? And when we understand that, is this the way we want to be changed? Because technology, in the end, is neutral. It's what we do with these very powerful tools that changes things. Just as a shovel can be used to bash someone over the head or dig up a field and plant it, so can a cell phone, so can a television be used for remarkable things that were never before possible. But we are using them mindlessly.
And I might add to that, you know, when I go in front of audiences, I have this slide called Confessions of a Phone Slave, and I ask anybody if they've ever been in a bad relationship, and I tell them that they might be in a bad relationship with their phone right now, but listen, this is true. I have a really good marriage, and I'm not just saying that because it's Sunday and I'm at home and my wife is listening. I'm saying that because, you know, a good, to Dr. Rich's point, any good marriage acknowledges that there are things that must be worked with and worked around. And this is not like heroin, where you can't really make ever a good case for its use. I mean, I don't know, maybe the dying soldier, but you take my point in morphine.
Right.
You can't make a case for its use. You can absolutely make a case for technology. Witness the conversation we're having is built on the stilts of extraordinary technology that is sharing information.
Yep.
So it's just a question of creating a better relationship out of one that has been far more one-sided than we have acknowledged until now.
And I would add to Matt's wonderful analogy to going on vacation and becoming more deliberate is that we are reactive to technology. We're not being proactive with technology or with any other part of our lives, because we're busy reacting to the technology all the time. And we're basically giving away not just our attention, but everything we do when we respond to these random pings from the outside world.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, yeah. I'm just going to go home and go to bed.
We struck them dumb.
No, I mean, it's just like, it's so hard to figure out how to help people balance this. And it sounds like it's really crucial to make everybody really aware that what they're doing isn't unconscious, it's conscious.
Well, and I think there needs to be some protocols moving forward. In other words, what can families do? What can parents do? What can I do? And I think in the next segment, we should probably discuss that. I want to thank Matt Richtel for giving us so much to work with here, Matt.
And writing such compelling books.
Not a nice shout out.
And yeah, and for giving us the quote monkey or the title. I want to point out that Matt's latest novel is The Doomsday Equation, but he's also a wonderful Pulitzer Prize-winning technology reporter for The Times, and he's the author of several books, including A Deadly Wandering.
Which is the book about this science and a mysterious car crash ultimately caused by a texter. Let me say thank you to you guys and to Dr. Rich, And the reason I'm taking off a little bit now is in the spirit of this whole conversation, I've got family time, and I want to honor it. So.
Oh, good. Thanks. Yeah.
You're modeling good behavior, Matt. Thanks for being on Right Turn Radio. We're going to need you back fairly soon to help us work through some of these things.
It's been an honor. Dr. Rich, I hope we get to talk soon.
This is great. A great pleasure. Thanks, Matt.
All right, bye, guys. Have a great final segment.
Okay.
Thank you. So when we come back, we're going to talk about what people can do about this. We're going to talk about some strategies that we can not unplug, but we can moderate this stuff so we can have better lives. I think that's a good way of looking at it.
We're going to do the phone pile. What's that? Phone pile?
The phone stacking.
The phone stacking. So I thought that was, do you want to describe that before we go?
Phone stacking is where you go out to dinner with friends and family and everybody stacks their phone in the middle of the table. And the first one who reaches for a buzzing phone or even a non-buzzing phone picks up the tab.
So that's
I like that.
That's
I think
strategy number one.
Tonight we're talking about technology addiction and what we can do. We have in the studio Dr. Michael Rich from Children's Hospital Boston. He's also the director of the Center on Media and Child Health.
And he calls himself a mediatrician.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, we thought that was kind of cool. So what can we do? It's something we need to become conscious and aware of. It's not evil, but we probably need to make some conscious decisions about it. What does the center do, and what do you think we should do?
Well, the center, which is available and has a lot of information online for free to parents, teachers, clinicians, anybody who works with kids, to really bring the research evidence, bring the science to bear on this issue, and how can we be mindful about our media use? How can we use these tools for what they do well and turn them off when they're not doing that well? So I think that you hit it on the head when you said conscious. First of all, become conscious. And then I have something fairly controversial, perhaps, because it always freaks parents out, because they want to know what screen time limits should there be.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there should be screen time limits for a couple of reasons. Number one is...
I can hear my kid jumping up to town.
From here.
And town going, yay!
Hold on a second. No. First of all, how do you measure them? How do you measure screen time? We now have screens around us all day, every day. So what we're really talking about is where our attention is directed. Just as Matt said, it's our attention that's being sold by Facebook and Google and everyone else who's out there vying for our attention. And instead of saying, I have 1 hour of screen time a day or 2 hours of screen time a day, because that will result in your child coming home from school and immediately getting in front of the screen for that hour. And at the end of that hour, he will never turn it off himself.
Mm.
You will come up at an hour and 15 minutes and say, hey, an hour's up. Oh, but this show isn't over. Oh, let me get to the end of this level. Let me do this. Let me do that.
And that doesn't sound familiar at all.
Not only does the hour stretch into an hour and a half or more, but it results in a conflict every single time. What I suggest that parents do with their kids, and you can do this with kids even as young as 4 or 5, is you think of your 24-hour day as an empty cup, and you fill it up with the things that you need to and want to do. You need this many hours of sleep. You need at least one sit-down meal with your family every day. You need to do homework. You need to get outside and play because, you know, you love basketball. You don't want... And by the time you get to the end of it, then you can see how much time is left for media. You're doing two things here. You are modeling and teaching them prioritization. Prefrontal cortex,
right.
You know, the air traffic
decision
control.
Making, yeah.
The other thing you are teaching them is time management, which is something all of us can benefit from doing better. And so from the very earliest on, you are teaching them this, you are modeling this. And speaking of modeling, we have to modify and be aware of our own media use. You can't be sitting there doing the crackberry prayer saying, turn off the TV. And we need to remember the fact that kids hear about 1% of what we say and 100% of what we do.
That's right.
And we need to be living the life we want to see them live.
Okay, some guilty parents.
And here's the other thing. I want to address that. This is not about feeling guilty. That is, again, falling into the right and wrong mm-hmm. values thing.
Right.
And when you get into the values thing, first of all, you do feel guilty. People walk away and say, oh, I'm going to go home and I'm going to cut every wire in the house and this. Nobody likes to feel guilty. So that by the time they actually get home, they have convinced themselves that I grew up watching TV all the time. So, and I'm perfectly normal.
Right.
In fact, I'm a stellar human being. So they do nothing. They
right.
just feel bad.
Yeah.
And it's not about feeling bad. I grew up in a time when there weren't seatbelts in cars.
Yeah, we were talking about that a
just
few weeks
because
ago.
I survived that time does not mean I don't use one now. And my children don't use them now. We have gained knowledge since then that has changed our behavior. We need to do the same thing with media.
What are the frontiers of research that you're seeing at the center?
Well, one of them is this idea of addiction, because it is not a recognized pathology in the medical community at this point in time. And we need to gather the data to show exactly how people are affected and exactly how they can be treated to turn this around. But we're also realizing that because we have collected as much of the data as we can find, basically we have the Comprehensive Library of Congress, if you will, on the interface between media and our physical, mental, and social health. And what we see is a couple of things. Number one is the changes are real, but they're not immediate and they're not one-to-one. And we need to have this whole conglomeration, this whole accumulation of evidence to understand that these changes are small but real and incremental over time. So we actually developed a new methodology for following kids through time, which we piloted in Manchester, New Hampshire over 3 years, looking intensely at their media use. And I'm not just talking about when do you sit down and watch TV. I'm talking about randomly pinging them and seeing exactly what they're doing and what they're exposed to, including that they're not aware of, the billboards, the screens mm-hmm. in the background, et cetera, and following their health outcomes over time. And we are about to actually roll this methodology out following three cohorts of 1,000 children each in Alberta, Canada, across the province, with preschoolers, school-age kids, and adolescents, and following them through time. So what we really want to find out is, what are these changes? How well do they hold? In other words, do they extinguish themselves over time as the kids get older, or do they really stick with it? And are kids who are playing violent video games, for example, more violent to begin with, thus they're attracted to them, or are they becoming more violent by playing them, or is it having no effect?
Right.
We don't know that. We only have cross-sectional studies at this point.
Well, this is...
This has been really wonderful.
This has been
thank you so much.
Wonderful, Dr. Rich.
I did want to mention that oftentimes after we have a show like this or I do a talk, parents have more questions than answers.
Yes.
And I did want to offer that online, we have an online advice column for parenting your digital native called Ask the Mediatrician. And that's at askthemediatrician.org.
That's wonderful.
That's great. And we will post links on our website.
We'll post links on our website and
podcast this.
Yes. Dr. Michael Rich is a pediatrician. I almost said mediatrician. He's a pediatrician in adolescent medicine at Children's Hospital Boston. He's also the director of the Center on Media and Child Health and an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Thank you so much, Dr. Rich.
Thank you.
For
thank
joining
you.
Us on Right Turn Radio. I'm sure we're going to have Dr. Rich back. Abby, this is just...
No, and really, read this book. This is Matt Richtel has written some wonderful technology thrillers that will take you for a ride.
And Matt's latest novel is called The Doomsday Equation. Check it out soon. You've been listening to the Right Turn Radio podcast. Check us out at right-turn.org. I'm John Cohan.
And I'm Abby Dean. Remember, be safe and ask for help.